When we say that knowledge is power, we tend to imagine that accuracy is more valuable than quantity. But the world of information has changed, and data is being compiled by a variety of means, noting just about every detail of our lives. Big data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think, by Victor Mayer-Schoenberger and Kenneth Kukier, describes the rise of our ability to keep tabs on just about everything from inventories to shopping habits to traffic patterns and the benefits and problems that have arisen from that tally. Victor Mayer-Schoenberger joined me back in March to discuss the rise of big data. It was a fascinating conversation, and we're sharing it with you again today. I began by asking, what are we talking about when we talk about big data? Where did the term even come from?
Well, it's tempting to think of big data in terms of size, to think that today we have so much data, and it's true. We have a lot of data. There's estimates that we have now 1,200 exabytes of information, and only 2% of it is non-digital. It's a huge amount. But in the book, we argue...
Exabytes?
Exabytes.
What is an exabyte?
Gigabytes, terabytes, exabytes. It's a huge amount. If you want to compare it, it's like the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria, the famous library of the antique, where every book was kept in this one library. Library of the Alexandria for every human being on Earth 300 times over. That's the amount that we have.
But that was a one repository. Who's collecting all this data?
Many data users are, because collecting it and storing it has gotten so cheap. But it's not size alone that really makes big data so special. In the book, we suggest that there are three qualities that make a big data what it is, powerful and insightful.
And those are?
Those are the more messy and correlations. That is, we have more data relative to the phenomenon that we want to study. We are accepting, even embracing messy data, and we don't so much look for causality, we look for correlations.
Now, messy data, meaning it doesn't matter whether it's totally accurate?
It doesn't matter as much anymore. In the small data age, the age that we've had for millennia, we couldn't collect a lot of data because it was so costly to collect information. And so each data point that we collected needed to be very accurate. But if we collect 1,000 or 1,000,000 data points a second, if a few data points are off, if a few data points are messy, then that's fine.
How much does a Facebook or a Google process each day?
An enormous amount. If you have to imagine that there is about 400 million photos uploaded on Facebook every day. It's a huge amount. Google processes hundreds of times what the Library of Congress holds every day. So these large internet platforms process and store a lot of information.
How is big data related to artificial intelligence?
Well, artificial intelligence tried to instill human intelligence into computers, and they failed. And so 20 years ago, computer scientists had a somewhat different idea. They said, rather than making computers think, let's just look at statistics, statistical inferences, and see how we fare with that. And they fared very well.
So we have all this raw data. Do we then need to have an interpreter?
Yes, we do.
Would that be a human interpreter, or would that be a computer interpreter?
We need a human interpreter because at the end of the day, even with large sets of data, we still have algorithms that need to be set in motion. They need to be programmed. We need to look out for certain patterns and so forth. So this doesn't work without the human being.
But we had Watson doing very well in Jeopardy without the human being, although I guess the human beings were inputting all the information that they thought might help.
Indeed. And if you think of a related field, machine translation, for a long time we tried to tell the computer how to learn a language. And 20 years ago we went out and we just said, look, statistically speaking, what word in English is the most likely equivalent given that context in French or in German or in Chinese? And IBM started by using millions of documents to feed into the computer so that the computer could learn, statistically learn. And that worked to an extent. But the real breakthrough came with Google when they fed in billions of documents. So like in many other instances, an increase in quantity then results in a change in quality.
But there is a problem when you're translating. Sometimes the literal translation is not really the complete translation. You might say, you might want to say something like a goat or a ram, and it'll come out as a goat, and people will not understand what they're talking about.
And that's why you need to have sophisticated statistical tools. What you basically are doing is not just to look at a translation word by word, but you look at full sentences, phrases. What is the likelihood that a phrase is equivalent to in English is equivalent to a phrase in French, given the context and so forth?
But you're suggesting here that relevance is not always the most important thing here. It's just the amount of data. Will computer systems eliminate the need for human judgment about the raw data's relevance?
To an extent. What is so powerful, so beautiful, but perhaps also at times frightening, is that that computers and computer algorithms in big data analysis learn by the amount of data that is available, so that we can use them not only to tell us whether a hypothesis that we ask is true or not true, but we can ask them to tell us what is the best hypothesis.
But isn't it also the way computers learn to play chess better and better?
Yes, and in fact, when you look at chess endgames with five pieces or seven pieces, then computers just beat every human being because computers have calculated the entire chess game through.
My guest is Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. He has written with Kenneth Couquier, who is a data editor at The Economist, a new book called Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You begin the book with the story of a new flu virus being discovered in 2009. Why did public health agencies so fear it?
The H1N1 flu virus that was discovered then was a mutation of the old, the common flu. And public health officials were wary, very concerned, in fact, because they thought that this flu virus might be deadly. And there was no vaccine that could be given to people to protect them.
So they thought the best thing, of course, would be to slow its spread.
Indeed.
How do you do that?
To slow the spread of it, and to know where it is spreading in real time. And that was really the challenge, because the Centers for Disease Control asked doctors to inform them of flu cases. But it usually takes a couple of days for people that are ill to go to the doctor. Then it takes maybe a day or two for the doctor to phone the Centers for Disease Control. And then the Centers for Disease Control take a week or so to tabulate the data and to calculate it. Google thought that they could do better by looking at search terms that people searched for online. And they used a mathematical model, and they tested 50 million search terms to find and identify the 45 best ones. And with those 45 best search terms, they can now model the spread of the flu.
And they published it in the scientific journal Nature. And then doctors saw it and said, wait a minute, how can we apply this?
Not just doctors, but also public health officials saying, oh, now suddenly we have a sense of the spread of the flu in real time, and not just in the United States, in other countries as well. That gives public health officials information exactly at the right time.
So that's a pretty positive aspect of the collection of big data.
That is an absolutely positive aspect. It saves lives.
In other cases, the story seems a little more complicated. You write about Oren Etzioni. He found out that most of the passengers traveling with him on a flight from Seattle to Los Angeles had paid less for the flight than he had. He was outraged, and it led him to collect data?
It did. he thought that the best strategy was to buy an airplane ticket as early as possible to get the best price.
I thought that's what they always tell us to do.
Indeed, but it turns out that that's not true. And so he, Oren Etzioni, a computer scientist, was so incensed by this that he scraped data off an online travel site to calculate what is the best time to buy an airplane ticket for a given travel and a given destination. And his system worked quite well, but then he licensed data from a large online travel reservation system, and it got millions and billions of data points. And with that, he was able to forecast with a 70% probability rate whether or not a ticket price for a particular flight would go up or down the next 7 days. So whether it was good to buy the ticket now or whether it was better to wait.
Since the airlines are inconsistent in this regard, how did he work that out?
He didn't himself work it out. His computers did work it out. He had billions of data points. He looked at it, and the algorithms came up with a very good prediction model.
So he could see it moving in one direction or another direction.
Indeed, for each flight using historical data. It turns out that airlines use algorithms as well to calculate the price for each flight. And so what he did, what Etzioni did, is basically reveal the algorithms.
So it didn't really matter what the airline policy was. He has actually created a business called Faircast.
And Faircast was bought up by Microsoft and integrated in the search engine Bing. But now other online sites like Kayak and so forth offer a very similar opportunity.
Have the airlines fought back?
No, because their algorithms are so wedded and connected to their business model and to how they operate that they can't, like a supertanker, steer in a different direction quickly enough.
Now, in this book, you also talk about the historic desire to collect data. It's always been something that has been sought and valued. Even in ancient times, governments try to keep track of the people through census, right?
And absolutely.
The biblical story is involved in that.
Yes. Collecting data has been a desire of any organization, governments, but also private organizations for a long period of time. It's just been extremely costly. That's why 100 years ago, governments came up with the idea of, rather than having censuses that were took a long time, the census in 1890 in the United States took about 4 or 5 years to calculate and to tabulate. And so government switched to samples, to just asking a small number of people, 1,000 or 1,500. And if they are randomly chosen, we can calculate up, predict up from the sample to the total. But it's a trade-off. It's a second best solution.
Well, that's what polling does, but polling
Indeed.
Doesn't always come up with the correct answer. We've seen some elections where the polling was inaccurate.
Absolutely. And what the polling also doesn't do is it doesn't give you enough detail and subcategory and subgroups.
Now, in the past, when the Romans took a census, for example, how did they use it? Was it something that they kept on file and then applied in later years?
Mostly kept on file and actually using it, asking it questions was very hard because calculating, tabulating had to be done manually.
And they didn't have the zero. That came in much later. So it must
Indeed.
Have been even weirder with using X's and I's.
And very, very cumbersome and time-consuming. It took the better part of 1,500 years for the zero to make its way into the West and to make life more quantifiable than before.
So it was compiled. And then what did they do with it?
And then it would sit there. We would use it to answer certain questions, certain predefined questions that we had. That's really the sea change that we'll see with big data. With censuses, but particularly with samples, we need to define the question beforehand. And then we go out and collect the sample, and then we can answer the question, hopefully. With big data, we can work the other way around. We don't know the hypothesis yet. We don't know the question yet. We just collect the data, and we gain the value from reusing it many different ways.
So in the past, we operated under the assumption that we had only limited amounts of data available to us. Sampling took care of that. And now we don't have to do sampling anymore?
We can continue to do sampling.
Because we continue to poll, and then we continue to write at the end of the poll, it has a degree of accuracy.
Sure.
Plus or minus 3%.
Sure. We can continue to do that, but oftentimes it blinds us to the details. Give you another example. For many decades, we have taken the vital signs of premature babies that were born hospitalized 3 times, 4 times a day in order to see the onset of an infection early on, but we were pretty blind. Today, with big data and with collecting over 1,000 data points a minute, we can see the pattern of an onset of infection 24 hours earlier and therefore provide medication much earlier on.
But we're using DNA sampling, aren't mm-hmm. we?
Indeed, another wonderful example, yes. There's private companies like 23andMe that sample your genetic code for a couple of $100s. That's helpful, but they can only sample what they know are markers, are important elements that decide whether or not you have an illness. But if a new marker is found by the research community, your entire DNA has to be resequenced. Steve Jobs did it differently. Steve Jobs had his entire DNA sequenced in order to battle his cancer.
But he had the money to do that. But that's a big data approach, you're saying.
That's a big data approach, precisely. And that gave him, arguably, years of extra life. When he did it, it costed over $100,000, but today it's less than $1,000.
Because we do it more and we become more efficient?
Because storage has been cheaper, sequencing technology has advanced, and because processing is so cheap.
So is this has that changed the way we approach the social sciences, for example?
Absolutely. Social sciences were originally instilled by the humanities, by big ideas about how the world works. With social sciences 100 and some years ago, we started having empirical data to inform our theories. But these were based on samples. These were based on a few data points in an information-starved world. In the big data age, the social sciences get turbocharged. They get much more data that they can take a look at and have analysis done almost in real time and at scale.
I'm going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to go back to that business about messiness and the errors that can result, because that's part of the problem here. If you collect a lot of stuff, there are built-in errors, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Okay, my guest is Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, who with Kenneth Cukier has written Big Data, a Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Stay with us for more. We're back with a conversation I had in March with Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, who, with Kenneth Cukier, has written a book called Big Data, a Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. It was a fascinating conversation. We're re-airing it for you today as we start this long holiday weekend. I began the second part of our conversation by asking, what's the cost in using all available data? Don't we have to accept some errors?
Yes, we do. Again, in an information-starved world, we only had few data points, and so we were very careful in collecting them. If we have collected thousands, maybe millions of data points, if there is one or two or three data points off, it doesn't matter that much. We can embrace messiness, some messiness, with big data.
But, okay, let's say a translation, a mistranslation, because the computer only has a limited vocabulary. That can lead to all sorts of problems, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. If we have billions of documents that we feed into the computer in order to calculate the statistical inferences between words, one or two or even 100 wrong translations won't matter because they will be drowned out statistically.
Well, there's also voice recognition. When I'm at the gym, sometimes I try to read what's being said because I'm not listening. I'm listening to my iPad. my iPod. Anyway, and some of the misspellings and the weird things that appear on the screen are amusing. But what I have to do is then retranslate them into real language.
Yes, that's right. And the big data response to that is probably not enough data has been fed into the voice recognition software that you have been listening to.
What is the Billion Prices Project?
The Billion Prices Project is a project that is coming out of MIT. At MIT, economists thought that the calculation of inflation rates of consumer price indexes always is delayed by a couple of weeks, even by a month or two. So we have a really good view into the past, but decision makers, particularly at the Fed and elsewhere, need more accurate data in a timely fashion. And so they said, what we can do is to go out to the internet and to suck down all of the prices of goods that are being offered online. And if these prices change, that is a reflection of inflation or deflation. And so they called it the Billion Prices Project that is predicting inflation rates and doing extremely well, so well, in fact, that the economist who is not trusting the Argentinian official numbers is now using the Billion Prices Project calculated or predicted numbers for Argentina.
Because Argentina was playing fast and loose with its figures?
That is what Argentina has been accused of.
Uh-huh. So in this case, they can actually spot yesterday Amazon sold this lamp for $100. Today it's selling it for $89. And if we see a lot of stuff like that, we realize that prices are going down.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
How do sites like Twitter and Facebook show their admiration for imprecision over exactitude?
Well, if you just look at things that are very well liked at Facebook, for example, they don't give you the exact number of likes. They don't say 63,712 people like it. They just say roughly 60,000 people like it. That kind of a ballpark number is good enough. Is helpful enough to tell us how much something is like. We don't need it down to the last penny.
So has inexactitude influenced database design?
Absolutely. About 10, 15 years ago, database design was still very structured in rows and columns, tables that are clearly defined, and you had to put every little data bit in the right category, in the right container. And then Google and later others like Yahoo and Facebook came along and said, but we store a lot of unstructured data. How can we do that? And they developed technologies to do that.
I'm hoping that this concept hasn't been applied to computers that keep banking records or launch missiles.
Not at all. And there is a lot of areas where we still need to count to the last dime. But there is many areas where knowing the general direction is just good enough.
You remind us that Amazon, when it began, featured the Amazon voice, which was considered to be the source of its competitive advantage. What was that?
The Amazon voice was a wonderful idea in the early days of Amazon. They hired some of the country's best literary critics to write beautiful reviews of books that were just coming out. And it gave shoppers of Amazon sort of a sense of what books to buy. And it supposedly also should entice them to buy books. Secretly, though, Amazon also worked on algorithms to make book recommendations. And then they did a trial, the human book review versus the algorithmic recommendation. And it turns out that customers vastly preferred the algorithmic recommendation over the book review.
Well, I'm always stunned by the recommendations that they come up with. I think, who do they think I am? So it doesn't always work.
No, not at all. But it is said that Amazon derives about 30% of its revenues just from the recommendations.
How are financial credit scores being used to predict personal behavior?
Well, credit scores that are collected and tabulated by companies like FICO turn out to be highly correlated to other behavioral traits in human beings. So, for example, the FICO credit score can be used to predict whether or not people are taking their medication on time. And so FICO publishes what is called a medication prediction score for
individuals.
How can
they figure that out? I mean, if I'm late paying my bills, how does that in any way reveal whether I'm taking my medication or not?
Well, it turns out for whatever reason that people who are late in paying back their credit card dues or making late payments on their mortgages are also the people who don't take their medication exactly on time.
On the other hand, we hear a lot about the financial credit scores being inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that anything that's extrapolated from it might be inaccurate as well.
Absolutely. And the inaccuracy of the credit scores are particularly troublesome in a small data age when we have a limited amount of data points that go into the prediction. Because then if one data point is off, is incorrect, it really changes the prediction, not the result.
So how can you avoid being fooled by randomness?
By being careful. By being careful that you, when you let the data speak, that you don't fall for spurious correlations.
Target has relied on predictions based on big data correlations. What have they done?
They were very smart in using the shopping information that they have, the transactional information about what people buy, and were able to predict with a high level of accuracy whether or not a woman is pregnant or not. A journalist from the New York Times has uncovered that and found out that they were highly accurate. But one day, a parent of a young woman called Target and complained bitterly because they had received coupons for diapers and other things. And he said, what are you trying to tell me? You know, we are a good house. And the Target apologized. But then a week later, the parent called back in and said, I have to apologize this time. There are some things in our household that I didn't know. And the truth was, the daughter was pregnant.
Now, I'm not sure I understand how that all works. But one of the things I've always been confused about is you go to a store like Target, and at the cashier asks you what your zip code is.
Mm-hmm.
There, I'm assuming that's also part of the same sort of collection of big data.
Indeed, and with the product that you shop and the credit card and the zip code, they can identify you.
Identify me as pregnant?
No, identify you as who you are. Hopefully, not as pregnant.
Now, it wasn't. They're a collection of raw data that you write about that they promised was totally anonymous, and then somebody from the New York Times was able to locate, pinpoint who people in the collection were?
Indeed. Big data has a lot of benefits and provides us with a lot of valuable insights, but there is a dark side to big data as well. And one of the challenges that we face with big data is that a technical measure of protecting our privacy, namely anonymization, de-identification of data, doesn't really work well anymore in a big data age because we can re-identify lots of de-identified data by combining data sets. So that's, for example, how a woman, a 61-year-old widow in Georgia, was identified not by her name or by her address, but by the search terms that she used to send to AOL and that were later released.
So is it possible to be anonymous? Does delete actually work? Or if you delete your history, are you truly deleting the history?
No, it's really hard to be forgotten these days. Incredibly hard, in fact.
I'm starting to feel paranoid here.
Well, to an extent, there is reason for being cautious, yes. De-identification fails to work anymore, so we need to think about different ways of safeguarding our privacy.
You begin your chapter on datafication with the story of Matthew Fontaine Maury. When did he live and what kinds of data did he collect?
Commodore Amory is perhaps the grandfather of big data. He lived in the 19th century and he was with the U.S. Navy, but after an accident, he was desk-bound and was asked to look at old logbooks. And by going through old logbooks, he found that these logbooks of voyages of Navy ships contained a lot of unearthed information. And he got a couple of people together to datafy, to take out the data from the logbooks. You know, these logbooks contained a lot of messy data. Some sailors were very precise in what they described, others weren't. But they took all the data out and they started compiling it. At the end, they had over 1 million data points. It was a huge operation, but they were able to...
And they didn't have computers.
And they didn't have computers. They didn't have calculators. So they had to do it all by hand. But they were able to predict the winds and the currents in the oceans much better, and that halved travel times.
So that kind of thinking later was applied to what we're talking about here.
Indeed, and datafication is exactly that kind of thinking.
And then there are some things that are hard to believe. You tell the story of Professor Shigeomi Koshimizu, who's studying backsides.
Indeed, he has been successful in dataizing our posture, so that when you sit down, every person has a different way of sitting down. And a different pressure point, a different sort of load on the left side or the right side. And he is able to identify people based on how they sit. Now, that has obvious applications. We could think of an anti-theft device in cars, so that we sit in our car, then we can start it. But if a thief opens our car and sits down, the car just would refuse to start.
There, you write about Louis Van Aan, who won a MacArthur. What did he do?
Louis Van Aan is a researcher at and a professor at the Carnegie Mellon University, and he had this idea that we needed a way to find out whether or not somebody is human online. And so he created a test, and these are the sort of squiggly characters that are being shown a lot of times when you sign up for forums or for emails, and you need to retype them in clear text. And that helped differentiate human beings from algorithms, from bots that would also try to sign up for these accounts. So this was pretty smart. But then he thought, maybe people who type in these squiggly letters could do something productive. And he created a version called ReCAPTCHA that did that. And so when you got these squiggly words, they weren't taken out of an algorithm anymore. They were taken out of books that were scanned. And so when you type in these letters, you're basically proofreading scans of books. His company, Louis Van Aan's company, was bought up by Google to be the essential proofreading engine for their books project.
There's a lot of other stuff in this book, including how criminal behavior is predicted. Some of it feels very positive. Some of it feels very Big Brother. In the long run, do you think that we should be worried?
Absolutely. Big data is a very potent tool, much like electricity or antibiotics were or are. And so we need to be careful in using it appropriately.
The book is called Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. It's written by Victor Meyer Schoenberger and Kenneth Cukier and published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Most welcome.